This is a download from the Post-Keynesian Economics Study Group, PKSG. For more information and terms of use, please visit www.postkeynesian.net. Sound recording and editing was by Tom Hayes of Anglia Ruskin University, Cambridge. Hello, my name is Mark Hayes, and it's my pleasure as Secretary of PKSG to welcome you to the Keynes Seminar at Robinson College, Cambridge. On the 15th of October 2008, I introduced the first session of the General Theory Reading Group with a talk on the theme Necessary Preliminaries. The talk is based on the prologue of my book The Economics of Keynes, A New Guide to the General Theory, published by Edward Elgar. You can also download a PowerPoint presentation to go with the talk from the Keynes Seminar page on the PKSG website. Enjoy listening. Necessary Preliminaries. Some years ago, Mankiw wrote Dubious Keynesian Proposition Number 1. Learning how the economy works is best achieved by a careful reading of Keynes's general theory. Since Keynesian economics is derived by definition from the work of John Maynard Keynes, one might suppose that reading Keynes is an important part of Keynesian theorising. In fact, quite the opposite is the case, says Mankiw. He goes on to say, with breathtaking arrogance, if new Keynesian economics is not a true representation of Keynes's views, then so much the worse for Keynes. Now, in this series of papers, I shall be seeking to demonstrate that the general theory is a difficult, but not an incoherent or tendentious text. It will rapidly become clear, I hope, that the macroeconomic theory of current textbooks is a new form of a classical theory that Keynes sought to refute. I should therefore issue a health warning to any undergraduates among you that reading Keynes may be bad for your tripos. Nevertheless, it seems to me that here in Cambridge of all places, we should be seeking to understand Keynes himself. In my view, there is much to be learned. But would the real Keynes please stand up? This is such a well-ploughed, some would say exhausted, field. So to try and cut through the thicket of interpretations, I've boiled down my understanding of the general theory to five propositions that have helped me to make sense of Keynes, and I hope will help you. These propositions about five key concepts in economic theory, equilibrium, competition, money, expectation, and liquidity, are set out on page 1 of my book. They relate to matters on which Keynes was either silent or cryptic, I think, because of an implicit framework, which he inherited from Alfred Marshall and believed would be shared by his readers, though perhaps wrongly as it turned out. So we begin with equilibrium. Which Keynes, which equilibrium? In my book, I identify at least four ways of defining equilibrium, and a clash between them means terminal confusion. Keynes is a Marshallian. He believes in equilibrium analysis, derived ultimately from physics, I suppose, but he uses it in a highly original and quite unique fashion. For the most part, the general theory is good old-fashioned comparative statics, although there are some dynamic passages between different static equilibria, for reasons that will become clear. So accordingly, the first important and almost certainly surprising idea to establish is that the key variables in the general theory are continuous equilibrium values. Income, effective demand, and employment are in continuous equilibrium. Now, one reason for this, or one justification, I should say, is that Keynes and Lucas, I suggest, implicitly agree that equilibrium must be observable if equilibrium analysis is to be of any scientific value, although, of course, they have quite different notions of equilibrium. Yet,
how can the system be in continuous equilibrium in a theory which does contain disequilibrium dynamics and, of course, unemployment? And here it's Keynes's treatment of time that is crucial. He takes up Marshall's distinction between the market, short and long periods, and he resolves how these should relate to calendar time. To refresh your memories, in Marshall, market period equilibrium is based on stocks of finished goods on hand. Short period equilibrium allows for employment and production to change with a given aggregate capital stock. And long period equilibrium allows for the adjustment of the aggregate capital stock by the production of new capital goods, in other words, investment. In both Marshall and Keynes, market prices are the only prices that are actually observable. The short period and long period prices are expectations in the minds of entrepreneurs. Now, Marshall linked the market period to a calendar day, the short period to a calendar period of months, and the long period to a calendar period of years. Yet for him, both the short and the long period are of indefinite length, merely logical constructions showing the way that things are heading. Marshall's quite realistic that we may never actually reach a given short or long period equilibrium. Expectations may be disappointed on the way. Yet, at least in his formal reasoning, he retains a faith in the full employment stationary state as the long-term anchor or attractor of the dynamic adjustment. Now, Keynes introduces greater rigour into Marshall's approach. First of all, think of the terms market period, short period, and long period as adjectives, not nouns. Thus, they each refer to a type of equilibrium adjustment, the market period relating mainly to market clearing and income, the short period to the employment of labour and the other existing factors of production and to effective demand, and the long period to the employment of new capital goods and the capital stock. Thus, and I think this is a difficult point, we need to distinguish the nature of the adjustment to equilibrium from the interval of time in which it takes place, as well as from the time horizon of the relevant expectations which prompt the adjustment. There's a lot in there. In the general theory, the production and employment decision involves two separate units of calendar time, which Keynes defines as the day and the period of production, which is a number of days. The day is Keynes's quantum unit of time, quotes, the shortest interval after which the firm is free to revise its decision as to how much employment to offer. It is, so to speak, the minimum effective unit of economic time. Find that on page 47. The period of production is the number of days notice of changes in the demand for a product that have to be given if it is to offer its maximum elasticity of employment. Page 287. And this definition is the macroeconomic counterpart of the period between starting and finishing an individual production process, or production period, which he refers to on page 46. In terms of equilibrium, the day has two aspects, the market period and the short period aspects. Thus, each day, equilibrium market prices are struck for the finished goods on hand, thus determining income, But also each day, the level of employment is set for that day based on short-term expectations or equilibrium expected prices. Thus, both income and employment are in equilibrium each day, which for all practical purposes means continuously. Furthermore, Keynes defines the long period, on page 48, in a unique and strictly short-term technical sense. To define the equilibrium on which the employment of labour and capital goods will, in theory, converge if a new state of expectation persists for the full length of the period of production. And note that this long period is not the same as the long term. I dare say this is very confusing on a first hearing, and we'll be spending much time over the next three reading sessions unpacking this. Nevertheless, if you do not approach the general theory with this perspective on equilibrium, I think you will become even more confused. So finally, how can we have an equilibrium with unemployment? In what I will follow Keynes in calling the classical sense, unemployment is always a sign of disequilibrium. This is because the classical notion of general equilibrium is a state in which all parties make their preferred choices, which implies that factor markets clear. Classical authors, old and new, see disequilibrium in terms of shocks to a long period equilibrium based upon initial conditions, including the availability and distribution of factor services, i.e. what we call the endowment now, the technology of production, Keynes calls it technique, and the preferences of consumers and workers, tastes and habits. In the general theory, the level of employment at any time reflects a position of short-period system equilibrium, conditional upon not only the standard classical list of parameters that I've just read out, but also upon the state of psychological response of consumers and owners of wealth to an unknown future. These psychological factors, divided into the valuation of investment opportunities, the propensity to consume, and the preference for liquidity, are in Keynes's equilibrium analysis just as exogenous as the classical parameters. Furthermore, the psychological factors are independent variables insofar as they're liable to sudden and substantial variation in the short term in a manner not shared or fully determined by the classical parameters. This means that Keynes's system is not closed like the classical system, in which the level of employment is fully determined by the parameters, and some of which, in the Marshallian version, are taken as fixed in the short period and then released as the period of reference lengthens. Keynes's system is open in the sense that the three key independent variables are not endogenous. That is, they are not part of the equilibrium theory. But nevertheless, the general theory remains a theory of the level of employment as an equilibrium value. Keynes has a notion of general equilibrium, of the equilibrium of industry as a whole, as he puts it, which differs from the classical. For Keynes, it is possible for the system as a whole to be in a state of competitive equilibrium, even though not everyone is in their preferred position. Entrepreneurs may have no reason to change their employment decisions, and labour has no power to make them do so. So to avoid confusion between these two senses, I use the term system equilibrium to cover the still more general case, encompassing both classical general equilibrium and Keynes's equilibrium of industry as a whole, with or without full employment. So now we turn to competition. There can be little doubt that Marshall saw competition as a force similar to natural selection and gravity. In mechanical statics, the problem is always related to being in equilibrium. Marshall uses the analogy of a basin containing a number of balls, which is tilted. The balls move smoothly and instantaneously to a new position of equilibrium without an intervening position of disequilibrium. In a similar way, Marshall's and Keynes's market prices are always system equilibrium prices. Any tendency to diverge from market period equilibrium is prevented by the countervailing forces of competition, and a change in the conditions of supply or demand leads not to disequilibrium, but to a change in the equilibrium price. So markets clear. There are no queues or rationing. The level of inventories is based on an equilibrium decision to buy or sell, based on the spot and expected future market prices. Thus, competition in supply and demand is the force that holds the system in equilibrium. And this is easier to see with market prices than with the expected prices of effective demand. And I'll be returning to that in depth in the sessions 2 and 4. But the same approach applies. Competition holds employment in equilibrium. Each day, we move instantaneously to a new equilibrium position. Now, clearly what I'm describing is a state of perfect competition, with instantaneous price adjustment and clearing markets, though not, and this is terribly important, not factor markets. So what about fixed and sticky prices, nominal and real rigidities, and all the rest of it? Well, they're not there in the general theory, or at least they're not part of the main story. Much confusion has been caused by reading imperfect competition into the general theory, partly through a misreading of what he says on pages 5 and 6, and of the degree of competition on page 245. Now, there are good historical reasons for this, including Joan Robinson's 1934 article, which was called "What is Perfect Competition?" Her aim was to define perfect competition solely in terms of demand, as, I quote, "a situation in which a single seller cannot influence price," unquote, and to undermine and dismiss the traditional idea of perfect competition as, quote, "a situation in which a single seller cannot make more than normal profits," unquote, a notion associated with the free movement of resources between applications. And all modern economists have followed Robinson, while Keynes remains with Marshall and Pigou. What Keynes calls the degree of competition refers to the conditions of supply, rather than to the slope of the demand curve faced by an individual firm. Joan Robinson wrote that, quote, "Keynes did not accept the perfect competition of the textbooks, but some vague, old-fashioned notion of competition that he never formulated explicitly," unquote. And taking her slightly barbed words with a due pinch of salt, Keynes's given degree of competition refers to competition among entrepreneurs and workers and is a matter of the obstacles to the free movement of resources, both capital goods and labour, into and between industries and occupations, and it's associated with what he calls closed shops, either of employers or workers, together with the other social and institutional resistances connected with voluntary unemployment. So these are the real rigidities so dear to new Keynesians, but they have nothing to do with Keynes's central argument. The degree of competition and the degree of monopoly are not the same thing. The general theory assumes that the degree of monopoly is zero. In other words, that individuals take prices as given and independent of their own actions. This means you have to approach the general theory as written on the assumption of perfect competition in the modern sense. Prices are fully flexible, in the short run as well as the long. We'll address why factor prices tend to be stable in a moment. And the assumption of perfect competition explains a number of important aspects of the general theory, including its abstraction from financial and industrial structure and from the distribution of income. Nowhere, I suggest, is Keynes's method more clear than in his treatment of capital goods as if they were individually traded on the stock exchange. For the value of a capital good thus to be independent of its situation in a particular firm or occupation requires the assumption that it can be transferred without cost or delay to whomever expects to make the best use of it. Thus, all finished goods, whether they're capital goods or consumption goods, new or second-hand, have equilibrium market prices that can be realised at any time. And this assumption of perfect competition also has implications for the interpretation of the meaning of liquidity in the general theory, and we'll come back to that later today. So in Marshall's theory, it's competition that holds market prices in equilibrium and then drives this temporary equilibrium, as he calls it, towards the short period and long period equilibrium positions over time. In respect of competition, Keynes's theory is no different, although his definitions of the short and long period equilibrium positions are quite different, as we've seen. So the micro foundations of the general theory are laid squarely upon those of Marshall. And it was not on the question of competition that Keynes differentiated himself from the classical school. It's important to remember Keynes's claim in his preface that his book would, perhaps would be more accurate in retrospect, be regarded as in essentially the classical tradition. So, if the general theory is a theory of equilibrium under perfect competition, how on earth and why does it differ from classical theory? In particular, if prices are flexible in the short run, what has happened to the convenient modern divide between the classical long run with flexible prices and the Keynesian short run with sticky prices? If what I've said is true, should we not always be in the classical long run, where only relative prices matter in the allocation of resources and money's neutral in real terms, the classical dichotomy? Why does the general theory not lead to the same conclusion if it shares with classical theory the concepts of equilibrium and competition? Well, Keynes's system equilibrium is different from the classical general equilibrium. In Keynes's equilibrium, entrepreneurs, here including both employers and rentier investors, are centre stage. The equilibrium position is determined by the spending decisions of employers, investors and consumers, and not by the optimal allocation of factors of production. Put another way, it's entrepreneurs who make the hiring decisions, not the owners of the factors of production. And this is the essence of the principle of effective demand, which I will address in a fortnight. There are good reasons for using this quite different concept of equilibrium. In all industrialized countries, we observe a wage-dependent workforce. Unemployed workers do not usually start firms, leaving aside petty trades. Capital hires labour, not the other way around. The monetary economy is an entrepreneur economy, not, in practice and for many complex reasons, a cooperative or self-employed economy. Furthermore, at the level of theory, there's a subtle but far-reaching inconsistency in classical theory. The current orthodoxy is that classical theory describes the long-run equilibrium which would be reached immediately if prices were perfectly flexible and agents fully competitive, while Keynesian or business cycle theory describes the short run, since prices are in practice sticky. The stickiness of prices, we are told, reflects both nominal and real rigidities, the latter including obstacles to competition, slow adjustment of expectations, and in more recent theory, things like asymmetric information. But this view of things should be called New Pigovian, not New Keynesian. We shall see next time, or in a fortnight, that on the contrary, Keynes's principle of effective demand also assumes competitive, flexible prices in goods and asset markets. Only relative prices matter in the determination of employment. The problem, as Leon Hufford pointed out in 1968, is that they're wrong. On the other hand, and this is perhaps the hardest thing for a classical economist to swallow, factor prices are not market clearing values. Like the psychological variables, factor prices are outside the equilibrium model. They're exogenous. The principle of effective demand can be and is worked out using wage units as the unit of account. The employment of labour is determined completely independently of the price of labour. The wage unit is the money wage of a standard unit of labour. The cost unit, which comes later, while not formally so precise, extends the concept of the wage unit to all factors. And Keynes devotes most of Chapter 2 of the General Theory to refuting, on entirely classical grounds, the idea that involuntary unemployment is the result of a failure to allow money wages to clear the market. Keynes's notion of system equilibrium does not include the clearing of factor markets as a necessary condition. If it did, the General Theory would no longer be a theory of a monetary economy. And the inconsistency is not in Keynes, but in classical theory. The basic tenet of classical theory is that money is neutral. Yet how are markets to clear, except through changes in money prices? Relative prices are ratios of prices in more than one market. And there's no guarantee that a change in one price will leave prices in other markets unchanged, as Hicks and Arrow and Hahn recognised long ago. As Keynes points out, the traditional solution to this problem is to introduce a deus ex machina, the quantity theory of money and prices. If the price level is fixed by the quantity of money, changes in money factor prices mean changes in their relative prices. Yet the quantity theory assumes full, or at least fixed, employment. So it's a circular argument that leaves no room for demand-deficient unemployment. Classical theory is only coherent on the assumption of continuous full employment or failures of competition. The perception of sticky factor prices, there's nothing in the general theory to suggest sticky goods or asset prices, reflects their exogeneity from Keynes's equilibrium model. Exogenous wages are not rigid or sticky wages. On this point, Keynes is quite explicit, both in Chapter 2 and the whole of GT Chapter 19. Yet, in a monetary economy, there has to be an anchor for the price level, if the price system is not to break down. Since the quantity theory, which does provide an anchor, but assumes away the problem of involuntary unemployment, it cannot be invoked to explain the price level. Classical theory does not take supply and demand seriously enough. In a competitive economy, entrepreneurs set their prices in relation to factor cost so that the price level and the cost unit move together. The cost unit, as I mentioned earlier, is Keynes's price anchor, one of his independent variables. And while it's possible to make certain generalizations about the relationships between his independent variables and between them and employment, and that's what he does in Book 5 of the General Theory, these variables are not endogenous equilibrium values. And this is what the classical mind finds so hard to accept. Exogeneity means not that the cost unit is unaffected by the balance of supply and demand, but that if it is so affected, it moves from where it happens already to be as a result of past events, not from one position of equilibrium to another. There need be nothing preventing the adjustment of factor prices, but such adjustment will not bring about the aggregate clearing of factor markets, which in the classical theory would require changes in the aggregate relative price. If factor prices responded solely to excess supply, they would fall to zero in circumstances of involuntary unemployment. I mean, technically, the factors of production would be free goods. So factor price stickiness is a condition of the stability of the market system, not of the existence of involuntary unemployment. However fast money wages fall, such a fall cannot directly alter the relative prices that govern the level of employment in accordance with the principle of effective demand. So factor prices are in a quite different case from the prices of goods and debts, which are indeed equilibrium market clearing values. So now I turn to the fourth proposition, only two to go, about expectation. So far I've argued that the general theory is an extension of essentially classical competitive equilibrium analysis, in other words, supply and demand theory, to a monetary economy. Taking money seriously means taking time seriously, and I've already set out the importance of Keynes's redefinition of Marshall's equilibrium periods. The understanding of time as irreversible has profound implications for equilibrium analysis. If today's decision to produce, consume, or invest is to be described as an equilibrium outcome, the competitive forces bringing about this equilibrium must also act today, in the present. Past decisions and future outcomes are strictly irrelevant. However, most production takes time, and the decision to employ labour or invest in a new capital good today depends on the market prices that are expected to rule in the future, the expectations, in quotes, when the final output resulting from these decisions is finished and ready for sale. And the Valrasian response to time is to postulate the existence of all necessary futures markets so that the forward price of future finished output at any date can be determined today by the balance of supply and demand. Under these obviously strong conditions, The future is reduced to the present. Time disappears, and equilibrium remains a meaningful, if ideal, concept. But in the absence of a forward contract, decisions must be made on the strength of an expectation, something which already plays an important part in Marshall's system. Keynes makes a subtle but important addition to the classical scheme by distinguishing between short-term expectation, which governs the level of production and employment, and long-term expectation, which governs the investment decision. The state of short-term expectation turns out to depend upon the state of long-term expectation, so we can follow Keynes in often referring simply to the state of expectation as a whole, but this shorthand must not obscure its compound nature. This use of the long and short term does not correspond to the long and short equilibrium periods. Keynes's long period equilibrium is based on short-term expectation and relates to a state of expectation which remains unchanged long enough to allow the capital stock to adjust fully to that state of expectation. Although Keynes's long period equilibrium is important for theoretical completeness, it's most unlikely to be observed, since the state of expectation is liable to constant change, far more so than the parameters of the classical system. Nevertheless, as we shall see in a fortnight, however much it may shift from day to day, today's state of expectation determines in the present the point of effective demand and the level of employment as a position of short period equilibrium. It is of theoretical but less practical importance that the state of expectation also defines today a position of long period equilibrium, on which the short period equilibrium will converge if today's state of expectation continues unchanged. And it's the limited likelihood of such stability that explains Keynes's persistent emphasis on the short period. Keynes treats the state of short-term expectation as reliable, or at least discoverable by trial and error, what we now call rational. Given the state of long-term expectation. But the state of long-term expectation itself is an entirely different matter. Keynes does not assume that long-term expectations are fulfilled even in his long-period equilibrium, where they're merely unchanged. And indeed, he considers disappointment of long-term expectations more than likely. I suggest that the period over which competitive equilibrium analysis is of scientific value relates directly to the time horizon within which expectations can reasonably be treated as determinate. The method cannot be applied to the long term, thus unfortunately wholly undermining the classical concept of long period competitive equilibrium, modern intertemporal macroeconomics. To assume rational expectations in the long term is heroically to assume a very unheroic world in which the future can reliably be predicted from knowledge of the present and the past. The state of long-term expectation is as exogenous in the general theory as the endowment and other classical system parameters, meaning that it's beyond the reach of equilibrium theory. It's a close cousin to those psychological variables, the propensity to consume and the preference for liquidity, both of which also reflect the historical nature of time. In the coming weeks, I hope it will become clearer why these three psychological states represent reasonable responses by purposeful individuals to the problems of time. In the real world, where the classical long-period equilibrium is logically unattainable, and therefore an objectively optimal response is physically impossible. So now we're moving into the mysterious area of the forces of time and ignorance, which makes GT chapter 12 both fun to read and amazingly relevant today, but whose analysis falls outside the equilibrium model on which I have so far placed so much emphasis. The particular point I address in the fifth and final proposition is the nature of liquidity, and how different Keynes's treatment is to what you might expect. These days, a liquid asset is understood to be one that can readily be exchanged or converted into money at a well-defined market price. My claim is that this does not capture the full meaning of liquidity in the general theory, and that Keynes distinguishes between the attributes of convertibility and liquidity. There is more to his conception of liquidity than convertibility. In principle, an asset with low convertibility may have high liquidity, and vice versa, however counterintuitive this may now seem. Liquidity is intimately related with expectation in the general theory, and its meaning is fundamental to the understanding of the book as a whole. The paradox of the general theory is that Keynes so emphasises the liquidity of money within a theoretical framework based on perfect competition, in which all assets are equally marketable or convertible. So why does he then discuss degrees of liquidity? And furthermore suggest that in certain historic environments, land has ruled roost in the hierarchy of liquidity. Land can never have been preferred for its convertibility, let alone as the medium of exchange. But Keynes claims that historically land has possessed high liquidity despite low convertibility. Conversely, in his discussion of organized investment markets, which come closest in practice to the ideal of perfect competition in terms of transaction costs and uniformity of price, he treats their liquidity, which he places in inverted commas, as an illusion and something distinct from true liquidity. So listed equity securities have high convertibility but low liquidity. Unfortunately, he does not provide a simple definition of liquidity in the general theory, although he does come close towards the end of the infamous chapter 17. My view is that Keynes's implicit definition of liquidity is the degree to which the value of an asset, measured in any given standard, is independent of changes in the state of expectation, as defined a few moments ago. Liquidity risk is therefore the possible, not the probable or expected, the possible loss of value as a result of a change in the state of expectation, which includes the state of confidence. So if we find in the general theory a hierarchy of liquidity risk, in which bonds are superior to capital goods, and money is superior to bonds, this hierarchy is of crucial importance to Keynes's division between consumption and different types of investment decisions, which later theory has neglected. Keynes's conception of liquidity is intimately bound up with his conceptions of the state of expectation and of the historical nature of time. Liquidity has value only because the future is unknown, and its value increases with our fear of what might happen that we cannot prevent or insure against. And we've had an object lesson in this during the last few weeks. So in the general theory, money is the liquid asset and dominant store of value, as well as the standard of value. And money's liquidity is the foundation of its non-neutrality. So, in conclusion, I've attributed a number of propositions to the general theory that will, I'm sure, not go uncontested, but that I have found to resolve many, if not all, the puzzles and paradoxes that have bedeviled the reading of this book. The propositions are somewhat startling for those accustomed to the new Keynesian interpretation of Keynes. Continuous equilibrium, perfect competition, flexible prices, rational short-term expectations, although long-term expectation is quite a different matter, and liquidity is something more than convertibility. In the coming sessions, we'll have a chance to apply these insights to the text itself, beginning in a fortnight with Book One, the contrast between the classical and Keynes's theories of employment. Before that, next week, we'll have Michael Ambrosi's contribution, which will address the connection between Keynes and Pigou, developing the theme that the general theory is essentially in the Cambridge analytical tradition and was framed as a considered response to Pigou's 1933 theory of unemployment.